is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, where I think it's going to be 85 degrees today. Well, this half hour is sponsored by Larson & Larson. Whether you are a writer, illustrator, or inventor, you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. The attorneys at Larson & Larson can help you. For a free consultation, call 727-546-0660. They're my lawyers, and they should be yours. Well, today is the first anniversary of Joy on Paper, and it's been a fantastic year for me, a year full of joy, because I've gotten to speak to so many wonderful authors and agents. And today I have a particular favorite of mine, one that I have read for many years, and it is David Hagberg, who has written the brilliant Kirk McGarvey series. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Patsy. How are you doing?
Great. Do you like to be called David or Dave?
It doesn't matter. But I want to make a comment before we started. I was listening to the intro music with the typewriter going. Man, that brings back memories. I started out as a newspaper man, a journalist, back in the 60s. It was all mechanical typewriters. And I really struggled to go from mechanical typewriter to the IBM Selectric. And I ain't nothing compared to the struggle I had finally getting into the computer age. But listening to that music with the typewriter going brought back some really great memories and scary memories, too.
No, I know. It always puts a smile on my face because when I started off, I started on a Selectric, which is very funny because I had gotten a job as a secretary, and I didn't bother to tell my new boss that I had never typed before. and so I arrived the first morning, and there was a Selectric, and, you know, I didn't know anything about electric typewriters, and I'm pushing everything, all the keys, nothing works. And finally, in absolute terror, I lifted the machine up, and I started shaking it and found the button underneath.
Yeah.
And that's how I started to learn how to type. And I learned very fast because I needed that job. So it was funny.
I talked to a lot of beginning writers, and they're very secure in their jobs, their marriages, and they get money and all that. And in a way, you know, I envy them. They've got that money and that luxury, but I pity them in a way. I feel sorry for them because they don't have, like you did with that job, secretary, they don't have the imperative. You learn how to do this stuff or you starve.
Exactly.
So that, you know, something snapping at your heels like a wife and four kids. So come on, feed us.
That's it. We need motivators, and boy, did I have them, and I know that you did too. And
absolutely.
You know, it's funny. Of course, you're from Minnesota, and yeah. I'm from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Oh, you're a Youper.
Oh, I'm a Youper.
Yeah, we just go skiing up there.
Well, you know, I'm all the way up from near the very top, tippy top of the Upper Peninsula. So if I was in Copper Harbor, I could look over all the way across, and maybe I could have seen you over there in Duluth.
We used to sail. We had a 30-foot sailboat. We used to sail up past there and then up across to the Canadian wilderness, and we just loved it. Froze our behinds off, even in the summertime, but that was a beautiful place.
Oh, and a wonderful place to grow up. Just fantastic.
A great place to grow up. Absolutely fabulous.
Of course, you know, for Youpers, we thought, you know, we talked like this. And when we talked about the big city people in Duluth, we were really impressed with you people over there.
Oh, yeah, sure, you betcha.
Yeah. So it was so funny when I noticed, you know, Duluth. I always perk up whenever I find somebody from up north because I know we've had similar childhoods, wonderful childhoods, where we ran wild.
Yes, we did, and it wasn't. The only danger was nature, like falling in a creek or something like a creek. Now here I've just falling in a creek or falling off a cliff or having a bear eat you or something like that. But there weren't like these crazies out there.
Oh, no.
You could go sit down and have a picnic, and you wouldn't be afraid somebody's going to come with a machine gun and kill you all.
No, my mother would pack us the peanut butter jelly sandwiches and give us a mason jar full of Kool-Aid in the morning, and she didn't expect us back until dinner time.
Adios. Yeah, I loved it.
It was a wonderful time. And, of course, it was a great, I think, of course, having the long winters, we read a lot. And we read in the summertime, laying in the grass. And it was just or in a hammock. Oh, gosh, those were days. And so maybe that's where we got our wanderlust, really, you know, from all the reading that I'm sure you did as a child and I did.
And I used to sit up in the hills in Duluth and look out across Lake Superior, and I wanted to go to faraway places and go have adventures. And if I couldn't do it in reality, I didn't mind. Because I started writing, I was like in the sixth grade, I started writing detective stories in longhand and spiral notebooks and all that. So I've been writing a long time.
Well, I did the same thing. I was on, you know, the west coast there of the Upper Peninsula has these wide beaches, long white beaches.
Yep.
And between gathering agates, I would just read and dream about all sorts of places that I wanted to travel to. And I did, too, much like you. I traveled a great deal. As a matter of fact, when I earned my first money, the first thing I did was buy a house, a little cottage in England.
Oh, cool.
Because I just, it was a dream that I got from living up north. Now, of course, you went into, you know, the Air Force and became a cryptographer, which is a fantastic thing. Because also up north, I know as kids, we all wanted to learn Morse code and send secret messages, and we were all into that.
Yep. This was cryptography in the Air Force. That was a whole different kettle of fish, because I was a ham radio operator, too, as a kid, and so I knew Morse code and all that. But this is something based then on Boolean algebra and a thing called a Fibonacci chain. In fact, I just saw a movie on my Kindle the other night of the Walker family who spied for the Russians. The equipment that he was working and sold out to the Russians was the equipment I was using in cryptography. It was kind of very strange to see that.
So it was your start into this wonderful world that you have taken all of the readers. And it was funny, you know, at first it's my anniversary program today, which I started a year ago on St. Patrick's Day. And because of leap year, it worked out fine that I had another program on St. Patrick's Day. And I wanted a writer that had, you know, or something related to Irish. And, of course, I thought right away of Kirk Culliff McGarvey, and I thought, whoa, now there you can't get a better Irish name than that. Now, are you Irish? Hagberg's Swedish name.
I'm a little bit earlier. My grandmother was Polish. My grandfather was a French Canadian, and my dad was 100% Swede. So, you know, you go from there. McGarvey, I don't know where I came up with that name, but he's modeled after my wife's brother. This kind of a calm, laid-back guy that if the house are burning down and all hell is falling around you, if Mark, my wife's brother, walked in, everybody'd calm down and say, okay, Mark, everything's going to be okay. It doesn't matter. He will make it better. And he just made things right. And so Kirk McGarvey started out, he was born in a ranch. His parents were ranchers in western Kansas. I have no idea where that came from either. but he just hates bullies, and he likes doing the right thing. And when I was a cryptographer and they stuck me in Germany, we built a big crypto center outside of Kaiserslautern, and all the guys running around, they were supposed, in civilian clothes helping out, they were supposedly electronic, you know, from the companies who were designing and building our equipment. But these tech reps don't carry pistols and shoulder holsters, so I found out pretty quick, and I was just a kid, like 18, 19 years old, and I found out these guys were mostly CIA, and then a thing called the National Security Agency, which is much bigger than the CIA, but nobody knew anything about. And I was this kind of wiseacre trying to learn how to write, and they sort of took me under their wing. And I go out and buy a beer, and here's a tech rep driving a nice Mercedes convertible. And again, these guys don't make that kind of money, but I talked to them, and none of them had really a great deal of money, but what they had, and Kirk McGarvey still has it, and it sounds kind of jingoistic, but they believed in the United States of America. This was in the 60s. And they were super patriots. They didn't do it for the money. One of the guys says, I do this because I get to know everything. And so McGarvey's motto was the same. I stole it from them. Was Superman's motto, which is simply truth, justice, and the American way. And back in the 90s, I was laughed at for that, because it wasn't cool to be super American and a super patriot. And of course, during the Vietnam War, it was everybody was down on. And I was a GI, and I was going to school at University of Wisconsin. Then and had to go in uniform, and students were spitting on me. I said, "Come on, guys!" And now, if you go to an airport and you see a GI coming by in the uniform, everybody says, "Thank you for your service." What a turnabout!
It is. It's a wonderful turnabout because I was talking to another Minnesota boy. Colonel Leo Thorsness.
Okay.
And I interviewed him. And, of course, you know, he was a prisoner of war for 8 years in Hanoi Hilton. And,
and Hanoi Hilton, he
was telling me, you know, how terrible it was when they came back and they faced all of this. And he has the same feeling how proud he is now that Americans, you know, embrace our military and do so much for them. So,
yeah, I think that's great. My books sold poorly in the 80s and 90s. My publisher has been a friend and publisher for years and years and years. He's more or less subsidized me because nobody was buying thrillers. No one was buying the American, you know, we're fighting the big fight. And all of a sudden now this whole big turnaround is like, yahoo, I'm all for it.
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of that had to do with sort of, how did somebody say that they can read the headlines for the news, but they have to read you to find out what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, that was kind of a neat quote, and I love that. What we try to do is I get a bunch of books from like other publishers and other authors, and that they're going to be published, and they ask me to give them a blurb, you know, for the back cover. And I'm, you know, always trying to think of something. I read the book, and I'm trying to think, you know, why do I like this book, and why do I like it? Why do I like that author? And so you're looking for these kind of like movie lines that stick with you. And it's kind of fun. And that was a neat line that somebody said.
Yeah, it was Ward Larson. He wrote you're The right? Assassin's Game.
Yep. Ward's a friend. In fact, we're going to be on a panel at the Venice Writers Festival on this Saturday, I think.
Oh, wow. Well, tell him I've been trying to contact him because I want to talk to him, too.
I will give him your information.
Oh, absolutely.
Ward's a good guy. He's an airline pilot, you know, and besides being a writer, but he's a very good writer.
Well, I know that because my husband's a pilot, and so I'm always interested in pilots.
Right, so, yeah. They have that. There's a certain... I want to say arrogance is with a certain self-assuredness because, I mean, you know, they're flying these 200-300-ton airplanes that right up around Mach 1, and they're flying people around, and they got all these lives in their hands. It's a pretty neat deal. These guys are pretty self-sufficient, self-assured.
Well, pilots are a special breed, and I think I had mentioned to you in an email that one of my projects is with the F-105 pilots of Operation Rolling Thunder.
Right.
I've been working with them for a long time, trying to get their story out there, and they are amazing, amazing people. And you're right; it's not an arrogance. They have a certain swagger, but it's that knowledge. I mean, knowing that you can handle something like that gives you a pretty good feeling about yourself.
Yep, it does. Yep. You're self-assured.
Exactly. Because if you aren't, you don't survive it. So
you don't survive it.
That's it. So, I do look forward to talking to Ward about his books. And, you know, it's exactly that. Of course, it started, we all know, anybody who's read any of your books knows about Joshua's Hammer. But we have to talk about the new book a little bit, but let's just talk for a minute about Joshua's Hammer.
Joshua's Hammer was the Bin Laden one, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 You know, after 80 books, some of it was
yeah. That was the one that really I think sent you, you know, into the stratosphere.
Yep. I read a book. I read everything, of course. Nonfiction by a guy by the name of Joseph Bodansky, and the name of the book, and he advised Congress on Al-Qaeda and stuff like that. Name of the book was Osama bin Laden, the man who declared war on the U.S. And bin Laden, it's a big bin Laden family. And like all these big earth movers that states rent to do, that's a bin Laden company. Bethlehem Steel used to be partly owned by bin Laden. They're multi-billionaires. So this guy was educated, very well educated. He had access to a lot of money. He got to Afghanistan, and he became a hero of the Mujahideen. And so he declared war in the United States. I said, man, this is, I got to do a book about this stuff. And, of course, the thing sort of predicted a possible strike by bin Laden at El Qaeda, and it came out a year before 9/11, and the paperback issue, the mass market issue, came out, I think, like June or July, and then September we got hit, and I was on some talk shows like Art Bell and all that, and the book went from doing okay to like number two on the list, and all of a sudden, wow, and they were saying, how could you predict that? And I don't know if I predicted anything. I just thought to myself when I read this stuff, man, it's going to happen. It is going to happen. And just exactly where, I don't know. But I would have never imagined the Twin Trade Towers because there's a lot of Muslims working there. I mean, it was a polyglot, several thousand people, and they were all from all walks of life, all countries, all nationalities, all languages. And I would have thought that would have been the last place on earth he would have hit. But
well, many people have said that they wish that the people in Washington would read your books because, you're so spot on. First, your early books, of course, were a lot about the KGB, the end of the Cold War, and did it actually end? I don't think so. Everybody's like, "Oh, the Cold War, it's over. We're all fine and dandy now."
And, but there used to be a program and a budgetary cuts for the CIA, because I've been out there. I know guys in the CIA, and what it was all about is these two older women. Their job on campus at the CIA, is a bunch of buildings out at Langley, and their job was to watch spy movies and to read books like the stuff I was writing and Ludlum and Clancy and all that were writing, and then write reports, because all we're doing as writers is saying, what's possible? Now let's use my imagination to string out a scenario. And they were then doing reports to the director of intelligence, and intelligence were coming up with possible scenarios that they had to guard against. And that couldn't have cost them a lot of money to hire a couple of ladies to read books. And they cut those budget cuts, I think under Carter or somebody, and they cut it, and so but they were doing that once upon
I'm time. Sure they did it under Carter, because I happened to I remember when that happened. I was in Tehran at the time working.
Ooh. And you've been some zippy places.
Oh yeah, I've been to some zippy places too, not as many as you. I didn't get to the Antarctic yet, but yes, it was definitely he cut everything, so yes. But so there you had when we first started with McGarvey, and the first book, I have to say one thing about the first book. We'll talk about the new book in a minute, because without honor, one of the things I love about that book, of course, is McGarvey had a bookstore. I mean, I love anybody who has a bookstore.
There's in that book was started, I said that McGarvey ran there because of an assassination operation that went bad in Chile. And he got dumped and everything else. Well, I've written a book that takes us back to McGarvey and that operation. The book is called First Kill. It's done. It's scheduled probably for next year sometime. And I had a lot of fun going back.
So it's a prequel.
Yeah, it was a prequel. It was sort of odd writing. McGarvey now stays 50. He stays about the same age. Yeah. Vicky Spleen said, come on, Dagwood Bumstead never ages. And he's been the same age since 1933 when he came out. Nobody cared. But I had to bring McGarvey back to in his 20s. And it was I couldn't give him the same knowledge and all that and experience that he's got now. So he had to make mistakes, and he had to kind of fumble his way through things. It was a learning thing for me and him.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
I had a great time writing it.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. That's good because as you said, in the first book he starts off, he's already in his 40s, and he's already left the CIA. Yep. Well, for once, and he comes back, and all the intervening years and all the excitement, and of course it brings us up to the current book, which, of course, he gets on the outs sometimes with people.
He sure does, because what McGarvey's designed, and I talked to a friend over the CIA, and he was a media rep. He vetted movies and books about the CIA to make sure they weren't crossing any line, and He just said that there's so many interesting things out there. There's a Chinese curse that says that may you live in interesting times. That was a curse. These days that we live in are just terrible for people, but they're absolutely wonderful for storytellers.
And now, of course, with the new book, The Fourth Horseman, you brought it right up to sort of a very, very timely situation.
Which scares me a lot. Pakistan is supposedly our ally, and Hayden, I think, who used to run the CIA, said it's the worst, most terriblest ally that we've ever had, even worse than the Russians in World War II. And now they've got a bunch of nuclear weapons, and they don't have a stable government, and they're worried about terrorists coming in and stealing the nuclear weapons. So instead of putting extra guards on these bases, on these depots where the weapons are stored, we're talking well over 100. They'll push 200 nukes within the next 5-6 years. Instead of hiring extra guards, what they do is move these weapons. They put them in the back of a pickup truck and put a tarp over them and drive them someplace else. No guards, no nothing, in traffic, and because they think there's more security that way. Who's going to stop some beat-up old pickup truck or an SUV? And that, excuse my language, scares the hell out of me because these things are floating around. So we get a terrorist with a couple of nukes, we're in real big trouble.
Well, you know, your books are always called, you know, heart-pounding stories, but this one is particularly heart-pounding. It really is a thriller. It's a fantastic book, and I really, I want to encourage everyone to go out and get it, because it's just a great book.
Those are very nice words. I love to hear that on a Thursday morning.
Okay, well, listen, I have to take a quick break, but I want to come back. I have so much to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about Voltaire, which was a favorite of mine as a child.
My favorite. His great one was the only thing wrong with common sense is there ain't much of it around.
Exactly. So we'll be right back after a few messages.
All right.
Hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, David Hagberg, the author of the wonderful and fantastic Kirk McGarvey series, And we've been talking about his new book that just came out, The Fourth Horseman, and about all his other books. And I want to talk to him now. I'm going to talk about a lot of things, but I wanted to ask you a question. Dave, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, I want to ask, have any presidents invited you to the White House to talk?
No, but I did. I send my books every now and then to the sitting president, and I sent a couple of President Obama, and I never got anything back. But I sent a couple to W, and the first one I got a nice letter from the White House, which I framed, and saying thank you for the book, and me and Barbara, thank you very much. And it was sort of one of these, just a form letter, and his signature was stamped. But the second book, and I don't remember what it was, but the second book, I got a handwritten letter from him, and I thought, you know, this is really cool, because he wasn't known for being a big reader, but he said he just loved it, and I thought, wow, that's a high point.
Well, actually he is a big reader, by the way.
Yep. I have two high points. That's one. And another one, I used to write under the pen name Sean Flannery, too, when I was doing my literary days. I was trying to be a literary writer, but there's no money in literature. But at any rate, somebody, some fan sent me a New York Times crossword puzzle she had cut out and had filled in. And I was like, Sean Flannery was number 64 across. I thought, wow, that's real Americana. That's as good as a bestseller, almost.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I'm hoping at some point somebody puts my name, Patsy with a Z, because, you know, it's an unusual name.
Yep.
And I got it from Jimmy Hoffa, who used to, when I was a little girl, when he'd see me, he'd say, Patsy.
And cool.
So when I write it, I, of course, wrote it with a Z. So I'm hoping that someday I'm going to be in a crossword. So it's funny how...
Isn't that neat? Yeah, it is.
I mean, that is a big accomplishment.
It is. Shoot, I had nothing to do with it. I mean, it's just this lady. And what really amazed me is, and I have that frame too, she had filled out the crossword puzzle in printing, and man, her printing was neater than my typewriting.
Oh, I love that. Well, I print like that perfectly too.
I'm horrible. My editor, who used to, now it's all electronic, but he used to edit me by hand. I couldn't read his writing, and he said, well, I can't read your writing. Because I started out, really, the first couple of books, writing with a fountain pen, because I thought, well, I'm going to be sort of Ernest Hemingway or Faulkner or somebody like that, Fitzgerald I loved, and I'm going to be one of those macho guys with a pipe and a sport coat with leather patches on the elbows, you know, and a dog and all that.
Well, I want to say one thing to dissuade people from this idea that W wasn't or isn't a big reader.
I know
people think that, but I one time was accidentally seated next to him. This is before he was governor of Texas. They seated me next to him at a very fancy dinner. Why I was invited to this, I don't know, because we were not rich. Everybody else in this room was like filthy rich, and we were not rich, my husband and I. And I happened to be seated right next to him. Now,
wow.
He wasn't the governor. He wasn't anybody then. And, of course, the only thing I know how to talk about is books. And we sat for the entire meal, because the rest of the people he didn't find interesting. And we talked for the entire evening about books.
Well, then that's why he sent me back these letters. I'd always, you know, the popular belief was he didn't read very much.
Oh, no.
I'm happy to hear that. I really am.
Oh, he was very knowledgeable. And, you know, I know books. So
yeah.
That's like I've been schlepping ever from one country to another, you know, so I've got a couple thousand books always with me. So.
Yeah, I'm looking around my office now. We probably got 5,000 books in the house. And as a matter of fact, when I was a kid in high school, she was in high school or junior, I was in ninth or tenth grade in Duluth, there was this old drunk, just this reprobate, who owned this Wally Hankins, and he owned this bookstore, and it was just all these used books. And I used to go down there and buy some, you know, 25 cents for a hardcover of Voltaire or Plato's Republic or something. And I mean, it smelled like a used bookstore. I used to love them. But between the stacks near the back store, books would come in and box, and he'd just dump them on the floor, and they were just piled helter-skelter to the ceiling. And I said, you know, I'd like a job here. I could help straighten this out. And he said, I got no money for you, kid. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll work for a book. She said, all right, you put on a day's work and you can take all the books home that you can carry. So I was a pretty strong kid, and I'd carry a big cardboard box on. And that started my library. And it was mostly like, you know, Plato and Homer and all those guys, maybe better translations today, but, you know, this stuff is a couple thousand years old. It hasn't changed. And so I did a lot of that.
Well, no, I think some of the translations, the old translations, are much better and much truer than some of the modern stuff.
I think they're softer and neater. Like, just as an aside, I've got, like, Tchaikovsky's Concerto in D minor, violin concerto, and I've got it on vinyl. I have it on those little tapes that you used to have, and I've got it on a disc. And I had somebody over, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and I played all three, and the vinyl sounded richer and nicer than the compact disc, than the digital did.
Oh, that's true. That's why there's been a big resurgence in the vinyl lately. Because it has a special sound. So we are both book people.
Yep, absolutely book people.
And it's funny, you know, there we are up north, and like you, I took a fancy to Voltaire early on in my life. Why? I don't know why. and it's amazing. Of course, you made that in your first book, Without Honor, that was one of Kirk's interests, was Voltaire.
Yep. Yep, because Voltaire was just this non-nonsense sort of a guy who went against the grain. He was always in trouble with the church and things like that. Like, one of his saying is, the Holy Roman Empire is neither holy nor Roman, and God is a comedian but who everybody is afraid to laugh with, and things like that. And I was sort of agnostic when I was a kid, and because I was raised Catholic, and at one point in catechism, I think I was like 9 or 10, I said, you know, to the sister who's teaching, I said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And so she sent me home, and my grandmother raised me. My grandmother used to go to Mass every day, and she was a little bit upset, but she let me do my thing. And I'm not down on any religion or anything. It's just personally for me. And so Voltaire struck a real nerve, because on the same token, he said he didn't believe in democracy. He said, unless you get people who are educated, and Thomas Jefferson was a Voltaire fan and said he made school mandatory, basic school, I think through probably age 16, because you can't have a democracy without an educated electorate. But Voltaire was also said, if there wasn't a God, we would have to invent one, because fear of God or that whole thing keeps the bad guys more or less at bay. And he said the only thing that's going to replace it is going to be education. And so, I mean, he just, as a kid, I was 10, 11 years old. He was just outside after catechism. He was my catechism, and I really went to school on him.
Well, the whole idea of freedom, which, you know, is what, of course, Thomas Jefferson embraced from Voltaire, this right. idea that we have to be free, that, of course, has been throughout all of your McGarvey series, that
yep.
that Kirk is really a simple patriot who wants everybody to, you know, of course, his methods are sometimes interesting, but he wants people to be free and not to be, you know, taken over by any group or any organization.
Yeah, when I first started McGarvey, this is funny, a couple of books in, I was at the end of doing the Sean Flannery books, which was more like Jean Le Carré, you know, the spies, there was a lot of thinking and a lot of things going on in the New York Times. Nugent Calendar was the pen name for any critic in the New York Times Book Review, and he reviewed, I think, Countdown, which is a second McGarvey book, and he says the only difference between Hagberg's McGarvey and Sean Flannery is Sean Flannery has, I think he said something like, one dead body for every three chapters. Well, McGarvey has three dead bodies for every chapter. He didn't. Nugent Calendar did not like me.
Well,
but that's okay.
Well, I think, you know, the public has embraced Kirk in a, such a strong way, because it is, we need people who sort of think clearly and act accordingly.
Decisively.
That's the problem. And I think, I can't talk politics because I'll lose half my audience.
Yeah, me too.
and you know that too. I had one wonderful author on, really nice guy. He wrote a book about history, and I really was so happy to have him on, and we're talking and talking. And then he went off and he started on a certain candidate. Well, it's the only time I got really bad email. I got like, why did you? I didn't know the guy had a particular favorite. And yeah. So, you know, we can't do that. But on the other hand, we can say in general,
certainly have an interesting political season that we're in the middle of right now. How's that sound?
That sounds very good. And I think that, Kirkwood have some real comments that he can make in the book.
There's a book I'm working on now. In fact, I'm about 60, 70 pages into it, and it's called Flashpoints. And Kirk McGarvey gets blown up in a car bomb, and he's going to lose his left leg, but he's still going to be tough. And it is, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but it's a consortium of people intelligence officers, like from North Korea, China, Japan, and places like that, who've gotten together how can I do this without ruining the whole plot? But who just basically, the president that's been elected, and I won't name any names, a fictional president, everybody on the world absolutely fears, hates, and despises. And so.
Oh, that sounded like Reagan.
they have got together, are working on a plot to make 9/11 look like kindergarten. And the first step is, I know McGarvey's going to be in the middle of this, so they want to kill him. And right now, chapter 8 or 9, everybody thinks he's dead. He's in a coma, actually. And it's like a couple of books ago, I think Mickey Spleen was the other one, said, if your plots are starting to sag, he said, kill somebody. And if you really want to zip it up, kill somebody important. So I had Kirk's wife and daughter and son-in-law kill a couple of books ago.
Yes, that was devastating.
Wife was so mad at me. I didn't tell her about it.
I was so mad at you. I was so mad. I couldn't. I really was furious. I'm telling you the truth.
Well, I got an email earlier than that from some fan. She's been a very big fan. Lives down in Key West. Says, love McGarvey. Hate the wife. Kill the wife. Save the baby. But I didn't tell my wife, because my wife was modeled after Katie, more or less, and the daughter was more or less modeled after our youngest daughter, Gina, and I didn't tell anybody. I was afraid. I didn't even tell my editor, and so I delivered the manuscript, and it was like 24 hours later, after everybody got to read some of it, they came back, Wagberg, what have you done? I can't rewrite it. I mean, it's the whole book. That's the way it is. And I hid behind Mickey Spleen, who was a mentor.
I know, but it was a devastating book, I can tell you.
I know.
It was.
What it did was give McGarvey a new motivation. It gave him a more determination, because these are bad guys who killed them. The assassination was meant for him to wipe him up. And so he's going to, after a bad period, he's fighting back 10 times as hard as he's ever fought back. And now I've done the same thing. I've wounded him grievously. And he's going to come back, and he's going to be at the farm, the training facility, and the young kids there don't quite know who he is. But here's this old man, and his hair is long again, and he's a gimp with one leg. And they think
I have no fear.
He's going to kick some serious booty.
I have no fear that he's going to, exactly. He's going to overcome little things like that, because he's our hero, and
He will. He's going to come back better, bigger, and stronger. If need be, he'll take off his prosthetic leg and beat you over the head to death with it.
And he probably will. So, is it fun? I'm sure you have nice connections to various people involved in covert things. So, I'm sure that they give you a lot of good advice.
Non Nobody's ever. In fact, a good friend of mine who was sort of a mentor, he was retired down here in Sarasota. This would be in about 82, 83, and he finally died. His name was Dick Scott. He had retired as the director of communications to the CIA, and he used to give me his, let me read his retired, CIA retirees newsletter, and he had a Kalashnikov rifle automatic sitting in his study, but he and I would talk long. He was almost like a surrogate father, because I never really had a father. And Scotty took me under his wing, and he said, David, I'm going to tell you all sorts of stuff, but none of it's going to be classified. What I'm going to tell you is the feeling, the just what's in your gut and things like that, and you can take it from there. And so I'm not, and same with the people I know now. A couple of them retired, a couple of them still, a lot of CIA operators get out and then become security advisors for embassies all over the world. And I knew a couple of operators, too, who still carry pistols around, but none of them are going to give any secrets, and I don't want them. They have top secret crypto clearance in the service, and it's more a pain in the neck than anything else. You don't want to know this stuff. And plus, it allows my imagination to go just bananas. And you play the what-if game, and I just love the what-if game.
And nobody plays it better than you.
Well, I appreciate it. You're saying really nice things today. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful thing about having your own show. I pick who I want to interview.
That's right.
So nobody can tell me, interview this person or interview that person. I only interview the people that I love. And
I was on a talk show once with a Canadian up in Vancouver, Canada, British Columbia, and in the studio. This is back in probably the early 90s. Kind of a portly guy with a beard and all that. So sitting in the studio with the earphones on. It was a half-hour talk show and all that. He was just very nice and personal. We got on the radio, and after about one or two questions, he looked at me and says, "Why the hell do you write all this crap? It's just garbage. It's terrible." I said, "Oh, God." And the rest of the show is this confrontation. I'm sweating bullets. I'm doing the best I can. I mean, this guy is really, really nasty. And so we get off at the end of the half hour, and he shakes my hand. He says, "Hagberg, you're really a great writer and a great on the show." He said, "This was a wonderful show. Thank you very much." I said, okay, but it was confrontational, like shock jock radio or something, I guess, at the beginning of it. But I was just sweating bullets. He didn't say one nice thing until we were off the air.
Oh.
So you are just, and most others that I've talked to are just wonderful. Thank you.
Well, it's a joy to talk to you. And as you said, you like radio. As a child, did you listen to radio?
I listen to radio all the time, and I've been in bajillions on bajillions talk shows. In fact, they had a thing called satellite radio tours, and where you sit, like if you're on Eastern Zone, they set up, the studio sets up like 4 or 5 minute segments with maybe 5 or 6 stations on drive time, East Coast. You start at 7 in the morning, and then from 8 to 9 you do, which is 7 to 8 drive time in the Midwest. And so you go, the Eastern, Central.
Yeah, those are sort of canned kind of things where you get to talk about the same thing over and over.
Yeah, same thing over and over.
But this is so much more fun because we can talk about Duluth and we talk about the Upper Peninsula. You know, it's so funny. Everything came late to the Upper Peninsula. So we were way behind you people in Duluth because we had everything really late. And we had radio until way, way longer than most people. So I was so lucky, too, to listen to radio programs and to it just opened your mind and imagination when you heard it on the radio. I think I still love radio.
I was born in 42, so I'm an old fart. So I remember laying on the floor in front of the radio in my grandmother's house, listening to Inner Sanctum and Saturday morning Baby Snooks, I love, and Buzzcoy and the Space Patrol. And that was, TV was just going to start coming out like about 50 or 51, I think. And I missed when TV came out. It was fine. It was something new and different. But I missed radio because I got to be there in 3D smell-o-vision, and I was there in my mind all the way.
Well, I have Sirius radio only because I can listen to the old-time shows on the radio.
Oh, cool.
I'm driving. I love to listen to those, all the mysteries, and it's just... there's nothing like them. It's fantastic. Yep. Well, I want to thank you so much. You have made this a very, very, very special first anniversary program.
Well, congratulations on your first anniversary.
Well,
you must
it's
be
been
doing something
it,
right. To
it's
be
been
renewed for a year.
It's been thrilling. You know, I've spoken to so many famous writers. Of course, Robin Cook and Sue Grafton and Brad Meltzer and all
good people.
All sorts of famous people, but what I also love is that I've been able to meet and have on my program local authors, you know, from the Tampa Bay area, and it's been wonderful to help them promote their books and to get them noticed, because I have a lot of publicists in New York who listen to me. As a matter of fact, I have people all over the world listening to me. I just recently got fan letters from Ukraine.
Oh, is that neat?
Yes, because they listen on the internet. So,
my books are translated into Russian, but and it was in Bulgaria somewhere too. But it never once did I get a nickel of royalties from them. So what are you going to do? Russians? It ain't going to work.
But it's thrilling that from a small a small area as Tampa Bay that I can reach out so far. I have listeners in the state of Washington and California, Texas, and of course.
Well, you stream on the internet, I'm sure.
Yeah, and as I said, to get a fan mail from the Ukraine. I was so surprised.
Wow, isn't that cool?
Oh, I thought, okay, the KGB's listening to me now. So that's a good sign. And maybe they knew I was going to have you on and they want to know what you're thinking about, because as we know, the Cold War is not over.
Oh, no, it's just starting up again. Come on, Putin and all that. Absolutely. And the guy is not a dummy.
No.
Very smart, very shrewd. He pulled out of Syria just a few days ago for the very same reason we should have pulled out of, like, Iraq and things like that. He didn't want to get the Russian military stuck in some quagmire over there. He's got other plans now. This guy is sharp.
Absolutely. And I'm sure Kirk McGarvey is going to come to the rescue at some point again in another book. So I want to thank you so much for being on today. And it's been a thrill for me. And I will have you on when the next book comes out. And I'm looking for the prequel. Oh, to the McGarvey series. It's going to be a bestseller. People are going to go crazy for it.
Oh, thank you very much. Kind words. It's been very nice.
Well, it's been a joy.
Thank you.
Okay. So until next time, okay?
Okay. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Oh, wow. You know, this is been just a perfect day. I started off with, I've got a lot of wonderful emails from people congratulating me on my first anniversary, and I want to just thank everybody who's been listening, and for those emails that I got, and for the likes on Facebook, and also I'm trying to get back into Twitter. I haven't been a real great on tweeting, but I'm going to start tweeting more. And I've had several people who have been inspirational to me on the tweet side. And so I'll do more of that, because it is fun to hear from people. Now, I want to also say that, of course, David Hagberg's books are available on his website, or of course, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. And this new book, The Fourth Horseman, is really fantastic. It just will grip you. Once you start reading it, you can't put it down. As a matter of fact, I put off housework. Yes, I did. I said, forget that. Forget the laundry. Forget everything. And I just read the book, because it is really very, very exciting. So I recommend you get that book right away. And then I want to recommend, again, for Easter, there are two books that I'd love to recommend to you. The Royal Easter Story is for young girls, and it's a wonderful book. If you still have time to order it, if you have any young girls in your family, order The Royal Easter Story. It's part of the Princess Parable series by Gina Young and Jacqueline Johnson. Very inspirational stories for little girls. And the book is beautiful. The cover is all sparkly, and it's every little girl would just treasure this book. And then I want to recommend Angela Hunt's The Risen. She wrote the novelization of the film Risen. And I will tell you right now, the book is fantastic. It is better than the movie. If you've seen the movie, read the book and you'll see that she just is an amazing writer. If you haven't seen the movie, read the book first and then go see the movie, because it will really show you, wow, what an author can do with in the whole novelization process, because that's different than starting off. Here she was given the movie and asked to write a movie, a book about it, based on the book, and she just captures the period. She's an amazing writer. As a matter of fact, another person who did a novelization is David Hagberg. He did a novelization of the Terminator movie, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And this also, you get this kind of assignment when you're a well-known writer, and they know you, and they know your work, and they call you up and say, can you write, can you look at this movie and write a book? And it's quite a daunting task, and I can tell you, Angela Hunt has done a brilliant job. And for teens, I would like to suggest, I want to mention, because it is the political season, you should get Doug Brunt's book, The Means. This is a political book. It's about a previous presidential campaign, but it's as relevant today as it was a few years ago when he wrote it, and I highly recommend it. And that's Douglas Brunt's The Means. Now, do you have a legal question? Do you know what a grant of rights clause means? How do you know how to protect yourself when you hire an illustrator? Send me your questions to patsy.radio@gmail.com. That's patsy, P-A-T-Z-I, .radio@gmail.com. Because next week, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson will be in the studio to answer your questions. I call him the writer's legal eagle. He's my lawyer. He should be yours, and he can answer all of your legal questions relating to intellectual property. So I suggest you send me an email, and we'll go over everybody's questions when he's in the studio next Thursday. And meanwhile, I just, again, want to thank everybody for listening in today, and I want to tell you all to have a really great weekend, thank you for joining me. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Oh, and I have to say, happy St. Patrick's Day today. Remember, if you're drinking, don't drive. Get an Uber and just enjoy the day, but be careful out there. Okay, so share the joy, and we're going to play a little Irish music on our way out. Happy St. Pat's Day.